be the judge and that he would be judging sinful men. But no, this world's greatest trial is, in fact, sinful men judging the Son of God, sitting in judgment of him. Now, you have heard of preambles to certain subjects, and today we really don't have a preamble. It's kind of a pre-ramble, because there's a lot of bits and pieces that don't necessarily have to be in any sequence or order. You just have to know that they're there in the background because they have a bearing on this great trial. And so we'll let you put the pieces together somehow or other. We won't try to put it in any order for you. But it'll be in the background, and maybe it'll be helpful from that standpoint. Just one passing observation. The memorial never falls on prayer meeting night. That is Wednesday. It never falls on the Sabbath. That's Saturday. And it never falls on Monday. It's just 4 days of the week that it can fall on. That's neither here nor there, but that's the way it is. That's a fact. All right, now, to start with, have you ever wondered about Luke 22, verses 9 to 12? Luke 22, 9 to 12, when Jesus gives instructions as to where he's going to keep the memorial. Where wilt thou that we prepare? And then Jesus gives such an unusual way of explaining something. Instead of saying, well, it's on a certain street, it's a white house on the right side of the street when you enter the city, he doesn't do that. He gives such an extraordinary explanation. He says, behold, when you enter into the city, there shall a man meet you, bearing a pitcher of water, and follow him into the house where he entereth in. And ye shall say unto the good man of the house, the master saith unto thee, where is the guest chamber where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? Well, why such an unusual explanation? Well, there's a reason for it. Now, it's important that we understand that on this last day, Jesus was putting in a command performance. He was virtually taking charge of everything that was going to happen. Entering into a very tight time schedule, he ordered everything so there could be no slip-ups. And Brother Russell gives this this explanation in reprint 3363. It has been surmised that Jesus took this indirect way of indicating the place that Judas might not be informed until the time for the gathering. In other words, from these instructions, even though Judas was in the crowd, he couldn't tell where they were going to be that night. So he couldn't tell the scribes and Pharisees. So by doing it this way, Jesus controlled the time element. He could not be betrayed at this point. He takes total control of all the events. So he gives this so that Judas cannot betray him before the appointed time. Later on, on the night that they were eating the Passover, in John 13:27, we see another feature of Jesus' command performance. He turns to Judas and he tells him, now what you're going to do, what thou doest, do quickly. At a given point, he sends him out and he says, you go ahead and whatever you're going to do, do quickly. He knew what he was going to do. He was going to betray him. But Judas apparently thought, well, I guess he knows it and it's all right. No harm will come of this. Jesus is a very powerful, capable person, and he won't allow himself to come into any harm. That was Judas thinking. So he went out, and so this timed it so that apparently when he sent him out, he sent him out exactly at the right time so they would return around midnight at the time of Gethsemane. Again, you see that Jesus was almost in total command of the events. He was taking tight control of all the elements. There will be no surprises. And we read in John 13:30 that Judas immediately went out, and it was night. So he responded. He was going to do it in that fixed time schedule. All right, then the next item is Annas. He was one of the figures in the trial. Annas, it is alleged that he had been chief priest for some 17 years and then appointed six of his sons in succession and deposed six of his sons in succession. He was a mean-spirited high priest. And whenever his sons didn't do what he wanted, he just took them out and put another one in. And he ran through all six of his sons. And then he appointed, guess what, his son-in-law, Caiaphas, to be the high priest. Well, you've heard of kingmakers. Annas was the priestmaker. He apparently was the power behind the office of priest. And he was very influential. It's alleged that he controlled the money changers of the temple and apparently amassed great wealth and power, and he was a figure to be reckoned with in that time and place. It was Annas who first and foremost wanted Jesus killed, especially after Jesus overturned the tables of the money changers, even though that was not the charge they laid against him. That would have not required the death penalty, so they didn't even raise that. And subsequently, after Jesus' death, Annas, sometimes people are out of touch with reality. They have power and wealth, and they don't realize how quickly that can change. Well, that happened to Annas. He was later dragged through the streets, he was scourged and murdered by the masses. All of his power, all of his wealth didn't save him. Pilate, he chanced to marry Caesar's daughter, Claudia, and was given governorship in Israel. And for that very reason, that puts him in a very prominent place in history, in a very critical role. He came from Barcelona, Spain, but his marriage cast him into the greatest trial on earth. He was too weak a man to defend the innocent. He recognizes that Jesus is innocent, and six times during the trial, he says, "I find no fault in him." He recognizes that he is innocent, and yet, when the trial is over, he it is that turns him over to be killed. Now, also, it's interesting to note that Pilate was a rather ruthless man. On many occasions, when the religious leaders had gone to him and they pleaded with him for clemency with regard to certain offenders, he was not known to give clemency. He was the type of person that when he found an offender, he gave him the full punishment that could be exacted and was never known to extend clemency, except on this last trial. For whatever reason, he brought the religious leaders up short, and they were totally unprepared for his unwillingness to commit Jesus to death. That kind of surprised them. They thought that when they came to him, he would be a pushover. He was always mean-spirited, and anything that was mean, they thought he would just jump right on it and do it. So they were really set back by the changing personality of Pilate on this occasion. Herod. Herod probably was the grandson of the Herod the Great, the awful one that slew the infants of Judah. But it was this Herod that Jesus stood trial before that also had killed John the Baptist. He had already killed one righteous man, and he seemed disinclined to kill another righteous man. He backed off from entering into judgment against Jesus. Then there was Barabbas. He was a determined fighter, desiring to restore national sovereignty to the nation. He was an insurrectionist. He was a revolutionary. He was willing to do whatever was necessary to get to the place where he wanted to go, and that was national independence. He was what we would call a no-holds-barred type of individual. He would do whatever he needed to do to win. And he also figured in this last trial. Now, Jesus' disciples also were interested in the kingdom, but they were taking a different route. They felt that Jesus was the Messiah and that he would restore the kingdom unto Israel. All right, then some other points. Remember that Jesus was a little bit distressed with the way the religious leaders did things. They had so many little peculiarities. They would say, well, if you swear by the temple, it's not binding. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, oh, now that's binding. If you swear by the altar, well, no, that's not binding. You're not held to any oath that you made by the altar. However, if you swore by the gift on the altar, why then, of course, that made it binding. And this kind of attitude distressed Jesus, and he renounced them on one occasion, and he told them that they strained at gnats and they swallowed camels. They had a disposition where they were legalists. They would make a big point about some little thing, and then they'd do something awful on the other hand. So they were the legalists, and so that's why we bring this up. They tended to go by very legal terms, and they had a law, and they broke all of their own laws in this great trial with Jesus. We understand that under the code that existed at that time, Judas would be considered a co-criminal or an accomplice and not a credible witness. Therefore, his word was insufficient to legally arrest Jesus. That's what their code called for. Two, their code prohibited the arrest of one accused of a capital crime in which his life might be forfeited after the hour of sunset and before the hour of sunrise. Well, it broke that one, too. Annas had no legal right to try or interrogate our Lord. He was not an officer of the court, and no provision existed for a one-man court in Israel. And yet, when Jesus was arrested, they took him to Annas. The code required at least 3, and then 2, and finally 73. He had no charge upon which to arrest Jesus, and only after Jesus was arrested did he try to find a charge. 4, Caiaphas, he was condemned before Caiaphas. Now, in capital trials, the judges were to deliberate 2 days and 2 nights on a light diet before a decision. In other words, no man could be put to death in the short period of time in which our Lord was put to death by their code. They were supposed to fast or eat lightly for 2 days and then render their judgment. Well, they laid aside this aspect of their code. 5, all voted against Jesus under Jewish practice of law. Unless the accused had one sympathizer in the trial, it was considered to be unfair. Well, so much for that. These are all just background things that it's well to keep in mind, because they apply to this trial, or 6 trials, actually. The way, when you read the Gospels, it's very hard sometimes to to get a handle on all the various aspects. But there were really six separate trials of Jesus. Three of them were religious. And then three of them were civil. But there were six trials that night. And we're going to take those six trials, and you can mark them in your Bible if you want, so that you can get the sequence of events so that you'll know which trial was which. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish them. And also to get the time setting, apparently they had their memorial, shall we say, supper around, or their Passover supper about 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock. And then they left the upper room, and chapters 15, 16, and 17 of John was not in the upper room, but was on their way to Gethsemane. There were three chapters there, so they must have paused as they walked. And Jesus must have paused and talked with them. And then the 17th chapter of John is where he prayed. This was all on the way to Gethsemane while they were walking en route. Then in Gethsemane, he was there probably from 11 to 12 or thereabouts. And then, of course, they came and arrested him just to get the sequence of the evening before he was taken to trial. Now, the first trial is in John 18, 12 to 24. Other Gospels have it, but the first one was before Annas. All right, Jesus was arrested, and we read in John 18, 12 to 24, "Then the band and the captain and the officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him and led him away to Annas first." So that was the first one. We know that. "For he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple," that's John. "That disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest." Now notice Annas lives in a palace. He's very powerful, very wealthy. 16, "But Peter stood at the door without. Then went out that other disciple." In other words, he couldn't get in. And John went back and he saw Peter trying to get in, and he used his friendship with the high priest to say, "Well, I'm a friend of the high priest, and yeah, bring Peter in." So they let him in. "Then went out that other disciple, which was known unto the high priest, and spoke unto her that kept the door, and brought in Peter. Then saith the damsel that kept the door unto Peter, Art thou also one of this man's disciples? And he said, I am not. And the servants and the officers stood there, who had made a fire of coals, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed themselves." And now we come to the first interrogation of our Lord. Verse 19, "The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine." Now notice, Annas doesn't say, "Well, now here is the charge against you." He has no charge. This is totally an illegal arrest. You cannot arrest somebody without a charge. Jesus was arrested without a charge. And so they bring him, and now Annas is going to interrogate him and hope that in the interrogation he will find something to trip him up that he could make a charge out of. And on this, you know, it says that Jesus was like a lamb to the slaughter. Well, he wasn't in this case. This was illegal. And you'll notice how Jesus stands on his rights. He very firmly treats this matter in verse 20 of John 18. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. In other words, he's telling him that I have had an open ministry, and if you arrested me, you should have found something that I have said or done in my public ministry and charged me with that. Then, of course, I will be prepared to answer the charge. So, suddenly, Annas realizes that Jesus knows his rights and he knows that they're bungling this trial. This is being handled improperly. And Jesus said, why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. I've done nothing in secret. I've been ministering for 3.5 years. Certainly you ought to be able to pick up something that I have said and use that as a charge against me. This is Jesus' defense. And he's standing on his rights. He's absolutely right. He's calling to Annas' attention that he is violating the law, that he has arrested him without a charge. And what he gets for this, when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, answerest thou the high priest thus? Jesus answered him. Now notice again, he isn't like a lamb to the slaughter. He turns to the person that smote him, and he says in the 23rd verse of John 18, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? He's standing on his rights, and he is calling to the attention of Annas, who is the legalist. He knows very well that Jesus has been arrested, and now he's been smitten illegally. So Annas backs off. He realizes now suddenly that he has somebody before him who knows his rights, and that they're kind of bungling this case. So Annas had him sent bound unto Caiaphas, the high priest, and we surmise that he probably sent word ahead that you better get some charges against this person. So when we bring him to your office, that you will have something to charge him with, because we don't have any legal charge yet. All right? So this next appearance is in Mark, the 14th chapter, verse 53 to 65, and this is where they go to Caiaphas. Now, and Peter tags along. Now, Peter was at two trials. He was at the one before Annas, and he's at the one before Caiaphas. All right, Mark 14, 53 to 65. This is the second trial, religious trial. And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and elders and the scribes. Now apparently they're all descending. They're coming to an illegal trial, which is at night, which is was not legal. But they are assembling nonetheless to sit in judgment. And the chief priests and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death. And guess what? They found none. They found no witnesses that they could really use their testimony. And they had to have two witnesses according to the Jewish law. So here they had arrested him, and suddenly they realized that we don't have anything against him. What are we going to put him to death with? And they're in a very embarrassing, difficult situation. They want him put to death, but they don't have any charge. So apparently they engaged false witnesses. Now you would think with false witnesses that you could hang any kind of charge on anyone that you wanted. But no, it was overruled that night that no, he was like Teflon. They couldn't get any charge to stick. They couldn't get any two witnesses to agree on anything. It just wouldn't stick. So we read in the 57th verse, or 56th verse, but many bear false witness against him, And guess what? Their witness agreed not. They couldn't get two of them to say the same thing. Embarrassing. And apparently they had engaged these people and they had told them what to say, but in the process of saying it, they bungle it. So this is a bungled endeavor. And there arose certain bear false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." But guess what? Neither so did their witness agree together. They couldn't even get this charge, even though he had said something to this effect. Not exactly that, but to that effect, they still couldn't get a unified testimony against Jesus. Then we read in the 60th verse, "And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee?" Well, there was nothing to answer. They didn't have any legitimate charge against him yet. And Jesus well knew this. And so Caiaphas, who had been warned to get a charge against him, is unable to get a charge. So now he does the same thing that Annas does. He starts to interrogate him to see if he can get out of him something that they can convict him on. And we read that in the 61st verse, "But he held his peace and answered nothing." As long as they had no legitimate charge against him, he didn't say a word. "And again the high priest asked him and said to him," now this is the critical question, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And in Matthew 26:63, it really is not a question, it's "I adjure thee." In other words, under oath, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of the Blessed. And this Jesus answers. In the 62nd verse, he said, "I am." Well, what do you say if you happen to be the Son of God and the Messiah? He was the Son of the Blessed, and he tells the truth. "I am." And then he reminds them of the prophecy of Daniel 7:13. "Ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Which was also a reminder to them that he was a legitimate Son of God and that he had also powers that would come with his sonship. That even though he was in weakness before them at this time, that they would see him on another occasion in power and great glory, and that should have been a signal to them to back off. Be careful. Slow down. You are dealing with a powerful figure here, one that's going to be coming with the clouds of heaven and sitting at the right hand of God. So proceed with caution. I want you to know that I am He. I am the Son of God, the Messiah, and that I will be forthcoming with power and great glory, which should have sent signals to them to proceed with caution. "Then the high priest rent his clothes and saith, What need we any further witness? Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye? And they all condemned him to death." All condemned him to death at this illegal trial. This was, they could not have, the Sanhedrin could not meet at night. They were meeting. But this was an illegal trial, and they would have another one when day breaks. But at this illegal trial, he tells them the truth, that he is the Son of God, and that he would be coming in the clouds of heaven with power. And they said, "And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to buffet him and to say unto him, Prophesy. And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands." But notice, this is the charge that is leveled against him. This is one of the reasons why Jesus dies. Because he is the Son of God. the Son of the Blessed, the Messiah. And then in Mark 14:66-72, we see that Peter is still at this trial at Caiaphas, and there's where he denies our Lord, and he finally goes out and weeps bitterly. Then we come to the third religious trial. This is in Luke 22:66-71. Now, this is allegedly the legal trial. This is daybreak. And in a sense, they are operating within the limits of the law. This is why they had to have the other trial. They knew the one at night was illegal. They're the legalists, you know. So they had another session. And this is in Luke 22:66-71. And as soon as it was day, notice that, it was daybreak, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council. Now they have formed the Sanhedrin council. And they ask him the same question: Art thou the Christ? Tell us. And he doesn't answer just the way he did before. In the legal trial, he drags his feet. And he said unto them, If I tell you, ye will not believe. And if I ask you, ye will not answer me, nor will you let me go. In other words, you've already judged me in the illegal trial. You've already condemned me to death. Why are you asking me again the same question? You heard my testimony before in this illegal trial. And he says, you're not going to let me go. So he's totally in control of what's taking place. He knows what his rights. He's totally in control of what's happening on this occasion. And again, he tells them the same thing in the 69th verse of Luke 22. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of power of God. Then said they all, Art thou then the Son of God? And he said unto them, Ye say that I am. Now, he had said that earlier, but that was the illegal trial. He doesn't give them the comfort of an admission in the legal trial. It just makes their case a little embarrassing, that's all. He's kind of putting them on the spot a little bit. All right, then they said, What need have we for any further witness? For we ourselves have heard it of his own mouth. Well, they didn't hear it at this trial from his own mouth. They heard it in the illegal trial from his own mouth. So this was not proper to carry an illegal trial testimony over into the legal trial. They were violating their own rules. And straightway in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate. So there's your three religious trials. All right, so they bring Jesus to the judgment hall. This is in John 18:28-38. Now here's where the three civil trials start. And they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Remember how Jesus had said that they strained at gnats and swallowed camels? Well, here they are again, right at it again. They didn't dare put the sole of their foot into the judgment hall lest they be defiled. If their shoe leather touched the inner court, they would have been defiled. But they could kill the Son of God, and that was okay. You know, sometimes it's funny what the mind does to people. They are so carried away, blind to other things. And here they are, straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel again. And Pilate went out to them and said, What accusation bring ye against this man? And there they are, standing, owl-eyed. And guess what? They don't have any charge. They don't know what to say. So they answered and said unto him, Now notice, these were the doctors of the law, the legalists. They said, If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him unto thee. But there's no charge. They're just saying, well, he's a bad fellow. He's a bad man. But they don't have a charge. And of course, I think Pilate is a little bit surprised that he's not talking to just ordinary people. He's talking to doctors of the law. And they've delivered a man to him without a charge. And they're very adamant about Pilate bringing some judgment against him. But they brought no charge. So Pilate says, take him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. Well, they want him to put Jesus to death, and they haven't brought a charge against him. They just say he's a bad fellow. He's a malefactor. Well, there are a lot of malefactors walking around, but you don't arrest them until they do something, until they break the law. So here again we see this is a kind of an awkward beginning for this trial before Pilate. That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled. This is in John 18:32. What death he should die. In other words, he had to die under Pilate's administration to fulfill the word of God because he had to be crucified. They couldn't have stoned him to death like under their law. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? Now, they didn't make this charge against him. They didn't say, well, we've brought him to you because this man claims to be the king of the Jews. They didn't bring that charge. But apparently, Pilate had known that 5 days earlier, Jesus had ridden into Jerusalem. He was aware of everything that was happening, and he suspected that Jesus was acclaimed king, and that was worrisome to him, but nothing came of that, so there was no arrest. So Pilate, in the back of his mind, is thinking that, well, maybe this is really why they've arrested him, that he is a king. And so that's the question he asked. But notice Jesus' answer. Jesus, in the 34th verse of John 18, says, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? In other words, he's saying, are you bringing this up as a charge yourself, or did the religious leaders bring this charge against me? And clearly they hadn't. And Pilate wasn't making this a charge, he was just making this an inquiry, trying to find out just what it is that's gotten everybody so upset with this man. And so Pilate says, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? He's still in the dark. He's still kind of floating around. He doesn't know what all this tumult is about. He's trying to find a charge. And then Jesus, talk about a command performance. He, in a sense, seals his own death here. He says, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. My servants would fight that I be not delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. So here Jesus is giving Pilate a basis for his condemnation that indeed he is a king. However, he qualifies it, and he says, my kingdom is no immediate threat to the Roman Empire. Be at rest. It's not of this world, but I do have a kingdom. And if my kingdom was of this present world, I wouldn't be here before you. My servants would fight that I be not delivered to you. So, apparently now, Pilate knows, in a sense, that he has some kind of a king before him. Some kind of a potentate before him, because out of his own admission. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. your own interview and your knowledge of my entrance into Jerusalem and so on. I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And Pilate saith unto him, What is truth? And when he had said this, he went out. And again, he went out again unto the Jews, and saith unto them, I find no fault at all. Six times Pilate says, I find no fault at all with him. To the amazement of the religious leaders, they expected him to be very harsh with whomever they brought in. All right, then the second civil trial is in Luke 23:6-12. It's under Herod. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad. Now, you can imagine that the religious leaders, their face was crestfallen, because as soon as they bring Jesus to him, why, Herod is glad to see him. Why, I've been looking all over to see you. And they could just see their case sinking beneath the waves. All Jesus would have had to do is ingratiate Herod a little bit, and he could have secured his freedom. Pilate didn't want to condemn him, and neither did Herod. He had already condemned one righteous man, and he was a little bit shaky about condemning another prophet in Israel. You could sense that. So, but anyway, he had heard a lot about Jesus, and he had never seen him, and now he was expecting that, well, gee, this wonderful miracle-working man is before me. How about a few miracles? How about showing me some of your power and some of the things that you've done? And how easy it would have been for Jesus to ingratiate Herod and to have gotten off the hook. But then he questioned him in many words. But notice now, Jesus says nothing. He refuses to answer. He will not cooperate with this trial at all, because he knows that Herod is not the one that's going to condemn him to death. It's got to be under Pilate, who is the Roman authority, the civil authority, the power that would demand crucifixion. And so he just stays quietly. And the chief priests and the scribes stood vehemently accused him. Apparently they see their case kind of sinking beneath the waves, and they're very, very adamant now. They're in a frenzy, and they're bringing all kinds of charges against him, but apparently not too clear and not very convincing, because we read, And Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. And the same day Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves. All right, so now we find that Jesus is brought back finally to Pilate. And this is the last of the six trials, and it's the last of the three civil trials. And we have this account in John 18:39. 40 and John 19, 1 through 16. And he said, But ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will ye therefore that I release unto you the king of the Jews? And so it was really Pilate that ferreted out this charge against Jesus. And now he is kind of making it a charge. The previous charge was that he was the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed, but they didn't bring that charge to Pilate. But here, Pilate had ferreted out this the second charge, and he is now addressing him as the King of the Jews. And they cried, then cried they all again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. Then in chapter 19 of Luke, Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. And said, Hail, King of the Jews! And they smote him with their hands. Pilate therefore went forth again, and saith unto them, Behold, I bring him forth to you, that ye may know that I find no fault in him. I find no fault in him, even though he's beaten him and everything, but he still is unwilling to give them what they want, to crucify this man. He's still holding off. Then came Jesus wearing the crown of thorns and a purple robe, and Pilate saith unto them, Behold the man. Now he's trying to use a little psychology. He's trying to put Jesus before them dressed as a regal person and regal robes, and hoping that this would assuage their bloodlust. But no, it does not. And when the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify him! Crucify him! And Pilate saith unto them, Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. Again, Pilate is dragging his feet. He will not cooperate with them to this point. The Jews answered him, We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God. And now, for the first time, they're kind of letting down their hair, and they're telling him the real reason why they brought Jesus to Pilate. The charge that they had against him was that he claimed to be the Son of God. And this was the reason why they were seeking his death. And they thought, well, when they told him this, that they would score some points with Pilate, that he would say, this man claims to be a son of God, and he claims to be a king. Well, sure, let's put him to death. But it didn't work that way. They were making their case worse, because we read in the 8th verse of John 19, When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was more afraid. He believed it. He believed that he was the Son of God. He had told Pilate earlier that he had a kingdom, that his kingdom was not of this world. And it was beginning to make sense to Pilate. He was a king, and he was apparently a son of a deity of some kind. And he had a kingdom. So he became very fearful. He was very upset when they told him that he claims to be the Son of God. So he was more afraid. And he went in again into the judgment hall and saith unto Jesus, Whence art thou? Where are you from? Where is this kingdom of yours that you are a king of over? And saith unto Jesus, Whence art thou? But Jesus gave him no answer. Jesus did not pursue this. Now, remember that Jesus is in total control. He knows that he's got to be on the cross at 9 o'clock. You know, for years, the children of Israel offered a lamb in the morning and one in the evening, at the 9 o'clock and at 3 o'clock. The morning and the evening sacrifice. And Jesus knew that he was to be the fulfillment of that type. That he was going to be the morning and the evening sacrifice. And that would end their need for the morning and evening sacrifices thereafter. That he would be on the cross at 9 o'clock and that he would die at 3. Indeed, he would fulfill that. But then Pilate Jesus takes control of this trial. And notice what he does in the 11th verse of Luke 19. Jesus answered, thou couldest have... Well, no, let me back up. I want to get the 10th verse, because here we find that Pilate is pleading with Jesus, really. Help me out. Give me some basis that, I can come to your defense. I'll support you. Work with me, and I'll work along to save you. In the 10th verse of the 19th chapter of Luke, we read, Pilate said unto him, speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee? This is Pilate's attempt to get Jesus to cooperate, to speak up in his own defense and help him to lift the judgment against him. And Jesus answered in the 11th verse, thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin. Don't you see in this, Jesus is taking Pilate off the hook. He's saying, you're not going to bear the weight of responsibility in my death. Those who delivered me to you, they're the ones that are going to bear the biggest responsibility. So I release you, Pilate, from the biggest guilt in this judgment. And I imagine that this was a turning point in the trial, because now... Pilate has Jesus' cooperation in his condemnation. He is telling him, I know I'm going to be condemned, but you're not going to bear the burden of this. It's going to be on those who delivered me to you. So you're kind of off the hook. Not altogether. There's still a certain moral obliquity that falls on Pilate's shoulders, because 6 times he said this man is innocent. And up until the very end, he claims he's innocent, but he still succumbs to the pressure, which shows that he was putting to death an innocent man, which, from that standpoint, would be against him still. All right, then in the 12th verse, and from thenceforth, Pilate sought to release him. He tried still, because he's worried now that this man is a king, and that he has a kingdom. And he senses that in some way Jesus is an extraordinary person. He does not want him put to death. But the Jews cried out, saying, if thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Now they have latched on to the charge that Jesus is a king. They didn't bring that to him, but as the trial evolved, they are using this as the leverage point to secure Jesus' death, that he is a king. And what are they saying? Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. This man is standing against Caesar's law. You have a competitive king with Caesar, and therefore he must die. And of course, that put fear into Pilate's heart. Now they had a case where a man would be raising sedition, making himself a king, and he would be hard-pressed to explain this to Rome. So this is the basis upon which they are securing Jesus' judgment. And when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. And it was the preparation of the Passover, about the 6th hour, very close, getting near the time of the crucifixion. And he said unto the Jews, behold your king. And of course, he then turns Jesus over to them to be crucified. But they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate saith unto them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. And then delivered he him therefore unto them to be crucified. And they took Jesus and led him away. But the interesting point in all of this was that now here was Satan with the powers of the Roman Empire. And here were the servants of Satan, many of them the chief priests and leaders of that land, had sold themselves to Satan. And yet, with all the power that the devil had, with all the power of Rome, with all the power of lying witnesses, they were not able to bring one false charge against Jesus. And I wonder sometimes if this isn't the a part of the answer anyway. You know, Jesus, it says, he cried to our Lord with strong cryings and tears, and he was heard, and that he feared. Now, what was he crying about? Well, I think the possibility was on Jesus' mind that he would be convicted of false charges, that they would... You know, if you have lying witnesses, you could almost hang normally any kind of charge on somebody and put them to death. And you would have these evil charges that were totally untrue against you. But in Jesus' case, the scriptures say that no weapon that is formed against you shall prosper. And here, with all the powers of darkness, they were not able to make one false charge stick. The two reasons that Jesus died were true. He was the King of the Jews. He was the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed.
Thank you very much, Brother Eugene, for helping us focus a little bit more on Jesus' last days. And it really is amazing, isn't it, how doctors of the law, could twist things and bend things to their own liking, to suit their own needs. Even though they would quibble over the littlest things sometimes and really come down hard upon some people. Not very much to be, should be very shameful with really what they've done. And as Brother Gene says, being used by selling themselves to Satan for that purpose, it really makes a person think about that and what Jesus had to endure. Yet, we appreciate the thought also of him being in total control. He knew that when his hour would come and that he had to die, he didn't buck that at all. He was happy to do that for the joy set before him. He endured the cross, despising the shame. And we're thankful for that, that he has done that on our behalf and behalf of the whole world of mankind. And that will soon be known by them to all the world of mankind, to the Jewish nation in full, and they will be sorry for what they have done and mourn for one whom they have pierced. Thanks again, Brother Eugene, for bringing those thoughts to our attention. We have some announcements just prior to the noon meal. The arrangement will be we will be handing out meal tickets towards the back of the hall or perhaps at the entrance of the next room. We'll be eating in the next room behind us there. I think it's the Elizabeth room. There may be some overflow, we're not really sure, into this room. We'd ask the brethren in the last few tables perhaps if they could clear their books, say two or three tables, that's all we'd need in case there would be some overflow to these tables. Please take a ticket proceeding out of this hall. There are two types of tickets. Children 12 and under will receive a different color ticket because their meals are half price. So keep that in mind and make sure the children get a different type of ticket. And we'll just hand the tickets in. Usually they had a basket. We'll just drop them into a basket as we come to the table where the meals are being served. There will be a sign-up list or sheet for tapes this afternoon. It'll be on the back tape table over there. If anybody would like tapes of the convention, they can sign their names and indicate which tapes they'd like. We'll be setting that up right after lunch. This afternoon we will reconvene at 1:30 and ask the brethren to be on time, be in their seats perhaps 1:25. Perhaps we can have a hymn or two before we begin our panel discussion on our theme text.